Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 16th of March, 2022, and you're listening to Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, discussing some of the latest news and events in the construction industry. And given current events worldwide, Phil, here we are discussing construction. While there's all that destruction going on over the other side of Europe, does seem a little bit inappropriate to me, almost as if we're ignoring the elephant in the room. How do you feel about that?
Much the same. I have registered on the Rooms for Refugees, Rooms for Ukrainians website the government have set up, but I don't hold out much hope that the system will be smooth and efficient and much will come of it. And in fact, the amount of people, thousands and thousands, I have seen the latest thing, I don't know what it, I can't remember what it was, but the amount of people who've signed up, I think there's a very small chance that any Ukrainians actually find their way to my house, but I have signed up.
Yeah, well, so have we, and I think the demographics of our little village in Devon could change quite drastically if all the other people I've heard have registered taking refugees. I mean, I think it's very heartening to see how people have responded to this. I think it's rather better than our Home Secretary's response so far, and I think the whole system of having to register on this website and the rest of it is unnecessarily complicated. I think it should be, you know, sort of fast-tracked in some way. But anyway, people have extended a welcoming hand. I think that's great, and I think it reflects very well on people in this country, the way we've responded. But anyway, we'll see what happens. As with all things in Ukraine at the moment, we just don't know. But I suppose we should get round to talking about UK construction, because that's what we're all about. So what have you got to kick off with?
Well,
today,
on the subject of Ukraine, briefly, we've reported this morning that Strabag, are they Austrian or German Strabag? But anyway, the foreign contractor, they're involved in one of the HS2 consortia, so have a particular prominence in the UK at the moment. But Strabag are partly owned by Oleg Deripaska, one of the oligarchs who's been sanctioned by the British government. I don't think he's been sanctioned by the European Union as yet. But Strabag have been moved to cut ties. They haven't been able to kind of buy out his shareholding. But they said they're severing ties with the Russians. So that's quite interesting. They're not going to be thrown off HS2 for having Russian involvement in them. They're distancing themselves from their Russian shareholder.
Yeah, that is interesting. I hadn't realised that. And I noticed also that various other sort of construction-related companies, I mean, notably, I noticed JCB and Caterpillar have both made announcements about their activities in Russia.
Case New Holland have done that as well now. I think all sorts of people have done, yes.
Because I know that the last time I attended a JCB press conference, which a couple of years ago, well, probably more like 3 years ago now, they were fairly gung-ho about prospects in Russia. They were doing pretty well. And I think that probably they were hoping that this would be an emerging market for them. They've been active there for quite a long time, I know. But I don't know how deeply they're embedded there, whether it's just a dealer. I think you told me that they share a dealer with Grove Cranes.
Well, I don't know the dealer that I met a few years ago at the time was both JCB and Grove Crane, and it seemed to me that they would have an occasional massive deal to the Red Army. It wasn't like sort of a steady, nice stream. Their turnover would go from gazillions to virtually nothing from year to year, depending on what deals came through. But it strikes me that, I mean, it's different for people who have a physical presence in these countries, but if you're trying to sell heavy machinery to a country which suddenly has got international sanctions against it, well, Russia's not going to have a lot of money to be buying big shipments of diggers and whatever money it does have is going to go to armaments, I suspect, at the moment.
Yeah, tanks, probably.
But I don't think, you know, the fact that CNH and JCB and CAT are saying, oh, we're not going to sell to Russia. I don't think there's any selling to be done, even if they wanted to.
I don't know. I had a vague feeling, and I might be wrong about this, but I thought the JCB had a factory in Russia. I'm not sure that they have. If a company like that, you know, does actually have employees in a country which is subject to sanctions, especially sanctions as swinging as they are against Russia at the moment, that puts them in a bit. It seems to me that it puts them in a bit of a bind, because they have obviously responsibilities to their employees out in that country. I suppose they can just shut the doors and say, sorry, mate, you're out of a job. But it does make it awkward for them, doesn't it?
While you were talking, I just quickly Googled JCB Russia factory. And it says he's got a small factory in Moscow. But I don't think it's much more than a repair shop. I don't think they... Or maybe they're talking it down now. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe that's where they make their boots and their liveried... you know, sort of PPE.
Oh, you know,
and
they
stuff
don't
like
do that. That's a branding job.
No.
JCB yeah. Action Men and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to change the subject. I want to change.
Yeah, go on.
Complete left turn. My favourite news item of the week, which I didn't follow up. We haven't reported this on the Construction Index. It's not entirely our thing. But I don't know if you saw what Sir Rod Stewart posted on Instagram.
A video
of him filling potholes, fixing the road outside his house near Harlow in Essex. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did see. I did see that, actually. Yeah, I thought he was looking for 77 years old. I think he was looking pretty good, actually. He was wielding his. I don't know if he just put the shovel down as soon as they turned the camera off. But there he was. Shoveling gravel into potholes. And I have to say, the state of that lane was appalling. I mean, it was. It really was full of potholes, and I'm not sure how much good Rod did, apart from perhaps spurring Essex County Council into action, because I think they've said now that they are going to come along and fill in the potholes themselves next month and do a complete resurfacing in July. So he might have only been out there for 10 minutes with his mates pretending
it
to
looks,
do it.
No, but it looks like more of it. It's a decent... I'm not really good on how big these trucks are, but it's a tipping truck with a... good few tons of gravel in the back of it, and it looks to be quite a stretch of road that they've been, you know, filling in. Obviously, it's not a proper asphalty reinstatement, it's just putting stones down.
He just wants it level so he can get his Ferrari over it, isn't he?
He's saying that ambulance person's tire, and I can't get my Ferrari down.
Yeah, exactly. Well, fair enough.
Of course, but it should be noted that the Stewart household are notably communitaire and public service minded, because if you remember last year, his wife Penny Lancaster qualified as a special constable, a PCSO, with the City of London Police.
Oh, that's right.
And I don't know if she's still doing it. There's certainly photos of last summer, I think it was, she was out, you know, one night on the beat with the City of London Police. As I say, I don't know if that was just a short-term thing for a TV programme or something, but she's properly qualified and did all the courses, or whether she's still doing it on the quiet, you know, behind the scenes and not seeking publicity for it.
And of course, Rod himself very generously stepped in. Do you remember, I can't remember where it was, but there was a model railway club. Some vandals broke into their clubhouse and absolutely wrecked. They wrecked the all these things. I mean, a horrible thing to do. And Rod, who himself is a model railway enthusiast, stepped in and I don't know if he paid for the complete refurbishment of the facility or something, but yeah, put his hand in his pocket and helped them out. And I thought, you know, he's a good egg, this chap, isn't he?
He certainly seems to be. Although there'll be people complaining that he hasn't filled in the road properly.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Well, that's a good news story for a change. That's nice, isn't it?
What do you want to talk about next, David?
Well, there was some... We've often talked in the past about jargon and the failure of people to say it like it is. And there was a press release, which I know you got and I also got, from an architect, I think it was. I'm trying to remember who it was.
Well, I'm not sure we should mention them specifically, because I don't think we should...
OK, all right.
I think this is the term you're talking about... I don't think they've invented it. I think it's just one of these modernisms which is gaining popularity. Let's get on with it. What is it? What are you upset about?
Okay. Well, there's this development near Cambridge. I think it's an MOD thing, a barracks or something, and they've got planning permission to build something called an active mobility bridge. Now, do you know what active mobility is?
Active mobility. Well, that's where you move and you move at the same time rather than you move sitting still, I guess.
Yeah, well, this is a problem. I mean, active mobility sounds like a tautology, you know, you're mobile and you're active.
If you're sitting on a 747 flying across over the oceans, I suppose you're fairly inactive there. So that would be inactive mobility.
Yeah, well, you're getting...
Is driving a car active or inactive? It depends whether you're...
That's inactive mobility.
Whether you're doing any braking or accelerating. And you're steering, your hands move. I mean, I'm barely
active. I think that's more passive mobility. The thing is, that active mobility basically means walking.
Means cycling.
It's not as simple as that.
Pushing your wheelchair along, scootering.
Yeah, it does. There is, in fact, a Wikipedia page devoted to active mobility, and it says that active mobility, soft mobility, active travel, active transport, or active transportation is the transport of people or goods through non-motorized means based around human physical activity. So it is walking, cycling. Not riding a horse, though. So an active mobility bridge is a footbridge. And I suppose you could say a footbridge... Does a footbridge not include cyclists? I don't know. Maybe they use active mobility because if they said footbridge, it would suggest that cyclists can't use it.
But to me, a footbridge is a generic term which may or may not have special conditions imposed upon it, whether, you know, cycling is allowed, whether it's a bridle way as well. But at the end of the day, to me, something is either the road or the pavement or the sidewalk, if you're American. It's
exactly.
A footbridge or a road bridge or a rail bridge or an aqueduct. And if you start, subdividing footbridges into footbridge / cycle bridge / bridleway, life's too short.
But it's a typical triumph of jargon over common sense, because as you've just said, if you mention a footbridge, everybody knows what you're talking about. They've got a mental image of what a footbridge is. If you start talking to people about an active mobility bridge, they have to squint and wonder what on earth you're talking about, because it's not immediately apparent. And so probably within the confines of the planning and construction sector, that would be recognised. But if you're talking to the man in the street or the man on the bridge, you've got to call it a footbridge, haven't you?
To me, it's a footbridge, whether it's got bikes or not, as I say. Now, when I read that it was an active mobility bridge, I thought, good Lord, what's on? And my mind suddenly went back to that
Millennium Bridge
over the River Thames, which bounced everywhere. And, I mean, that's what I call an active mobility bridge. The bridge is actually active.
Yeah, like a bouncy castle.
We've occasionally reported on places where you can walk along the pavement and it lights up and flashes, or it can... Action of foot upon ground generates electricity, which lights up an advertising hoarding on occasional instances, installations like this, as a sort of showcase basis.
Yeah.
And I thought it was something like that. I thought, oh, this, you know, active mobility, something active, you know, it's happening. No, the bridge just sits there. People walk across it or cycle across it or push themselves across it. It's just a bridge.
Oh, I see. Now, that's interesting. So the term active mobility bridge actually stimulated your
interest. I got interested. Yeah.
Maybe that's why they used it. Yeah, maybe that's why they used the term. If they'd said footbridge, you say footbridge. Nah.
Yeah, I thought.
It's not that interesting. I mean, I have to say, have you looked at the CGI of the bridge?
Yes, I've got it.
Because it's quite a good-looking bridge, I have to say. So, I mean, I wouldn't knock it for that. It looks like quite an elegant structure, but it's still a footbridge.
David, when have CGIs ever looked like the finished thing?
Yeah, good question.
I bet the CGI of Maidstone Travelodge looked fabulous. Hang on, do I mean Travelodge? What's the other budget hotel chain?
Premier Inn.
Premier Inn. Can't remember. It's one of those in the middle of Maidstone. It's absolutely hideous.
Well, I will be able to judge soon because we've discussed in the past my local leisure centre, Barnstaple Leisure Centre, is now nearing completion. It's due for completion next month, in fact. And I have visited it under construction, and it was very much under construction. I mean, there was virtually no cladding on it. And in fact, I haven't even been past it since about October last year. It's tucked away in an area I seldom go to because I don't go to leisure centres that very often. But I'm going to go along and have a look at it when they open it and see if it looks like the CGI pictures that I've seen. So I'll be able to report back on
Excellent.
That.
And then you have to report back in 10 years' time, see whether it still looks like them.
Yeah.
Or whether it's rusty and fading. And
well, let's hope it isn't.
Moving on?
Yeah, moving on.
As you know today, we're back in our weekly cycle, thanks to our kind sponsors, those lovely Procore people.
Yes, indeed.
We have, however, and we've been in this position before, a bit of a dilemma because we record this on Wednesday mornings, and we'll be finishing next week's chat if all goes to plan, just before the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, stands up to deliver his budget. So we'll be a bit kind of out of the loop then. So I thought we should talk about the budget ahead of times today so that when people hear this podcast, if they choose to listen to this podcast, hopefully they're hearing us talking before they know what Rishi Sunak has said and we're not sort of guessing something that everyone else already knows.
Yes, that's a very good point.
Does that make sense? So should we have our budget conversation?
Yeah, I think so. We'll have our budget conversation now. We can always revisit it in a couple of weeks' time after we've found out what he's been saying. But of course, Rishi Sunak's last couple of budgets have been quite interesting for the construction industry because of the measures that he's introduced. And probably the most controversial was the decision to phase out the use of, well, not actually phase out, but to just get rid of the use of red diesel for construction activities. And of course, that will take effect. I think it's the 1st of April, isn't it? When the
it is.
When the red diesel rebate ends. It's not just... Not everybody who uses red diesel is going to lose the rebate. People like, I think, boatyards, circuses and...
Golf courses.
Golf courses, that's right. They can still use it. But construction companies can't. And I think that's a bit unfair. And, you know, just to recap, the reason that Rishi Sunak is doing this is to, I think, first of all, to try and get a bit more money into the government coffers. But mainly is to encourage the transition to alternative fuels than diesel. So, you know, sort of hydro-treated vegetable oil and electric and even hydrogen power.
But doesn't it, hang on, I would agree that it might encourage the use of battery-powered vehicles or plug-in vehicles or even hydrogen-powered vehicles. It doesn't in any way encourage the use of green, eco-friendly vegetable oil, HVO, because that's taxed at the same...
Yeah, it is.
The same rate.
The funny thing is, though, people are very keen on HVO. I mean, even though it's expensive, it doesn't get a rebate and it's quite expensive anyway.
Ticks the box.
And I think I was quite surprised actually how widespread the adoption or the intention to adopt HVO is. And I think maybe people are thinking, well, if you're going to lose the red diesel rebate, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, we might as well go to the eco option rather than go to white diesel, go straight to HVO. And so maybe that's a factor, I don't know. But people...
Well, if I was the Chancellor...
Go on.
I was going to say, if I was the Chancellor, I'd put the rebate onto HVO. I understand that... I mean, the reason why the construction industry is so upset at the moment about losing red diesel is because the price of diesel for everyone, the forecourt prices everywhere across the board, has shot up in the past past couple of months. But why the construction industry should be kind of, oh, diesel's expensive, we'll let the construction industry off the hook, but not motorists or hauliers or anyone else who's you know, paying full forecourt prices and not having a rebate. I think there's an element of special pleading. I'm not hugely sympathetic to the idea that, you know, now that we know red diesel is going, I mean, I think it's pretty outrageous that construction has been singled out, whereas, you know, forestry, agriculture and everyone else is still getting the rebate. I do think it should be all or nothing. But I think that if the rebate, which, let's remember, is my money, your money, everyone listening, it's taxpayers' money giving a subsidy to construction companies. That's what it all comes down to. That I don't see why some people should still get the subsidy and not the construction industry. I mean, that's unfair. I think if you're going to get rid of the red diesel rebate, get rid of it across the board. But I think it should be reinstated or instated for HVO and similar other eco-diesels.
And I think a lot of other people have made that point. And it just seems that the plea is falling on deaf ears. There's been absolutely no suggestion that the government is going to modify its stance on this at all. In fact, a lot of people, you reported, I think last week, that I think it's 14 industry bodies have lobbied the Chancellor in a rather vain attempt to get him to change his mind about the red diesel rebate right at the very last minute. But although, you know, I can't see any chance that he's going to do anything about it. A lot of people have actually said that, you know, citing COVID, of course, and the fact that, you know, the arrival of COVID sort of interrupted this sort of transition to more eco-friendly power sources, and therefore we need a little bit more extra time to make that transition. And then more recently, citing the war in Ukraine and the effect this is having on fuel prices as another reason why the Chancellor should rethink it, because, you know, we'd be struggling to find the extra money for the non-rebated diesel without all this, but prices have gone up massively anyway.
But David, you and I have listened to construction industry lobbyists for the past 30 years. And okay, it's at the moment it's Ukraine and it's COVID and those have happened. Before that, it was Brexit. But when you haven't got those things, it's, oh, we've had too much rain or not enough rain, or it's too cold or it's too hot, or there's a K in the month. There's no K in any month. These lobbyists always find some special pleading to promote their vested interest, you know, over and above the interest of the taxpayer and the wider economy.
Well, yes, of course. And I suppose that's what they would do. And you can't blame them for doing that. They'll use any...
It's
their job. They'll use any argument they can. And I think there are some... You know, you can sympathise for them. Yes, it is going to be more painful than they originally thought. I mean, it's going to be painful anyway, but it's going to be more painful because of the increase in fuel prices.
But you pass it on.
Well,
if that's what the price is, and in the end of the day, it's a lot of construction machinery is the ultimate end client is the state. Yeah. It is the public sector, the taxpayer. Yeah. So. Yeah, it all comes back to the taxpayer paying higher bills to the construction companies. But, you know, I'm all for removing subsidies as far as possible throughout, and then having everything fairly and, you know, priced, transparently priced, and saying this is the actual cost of this. I mean, equally, the whole business of paying tax and getting tax rebates, you know, that all seems like a nonsense. If you're, if you pay your VAT and you get your VAT back, I mean, now we've got the reverse charge VAT. But there's an awful lot of, it seems to me, unnecessary complication with the whole system of rebates and taxes and subsidies and taxes. If you can just, you know...
Streamline it.
Cut through that, yeah.
Yeah, I guess, you're right. I suppose if they were to... lobby the government saying, you know, this is going to have a massive effect on the economy and on taxpayers, that might carry more weight. And perhaps, you know, if they say we're going to have to pass this on and your electorate are going to have to pay for it, maybe they'll listen. I don't know.
I think that is part of the argument, to be fair. They are saying that to a certain extent, but it doesn't entirely sound like that. I noticed, by the way, there's a petition on the, you know, the Parliament petition page where people can set up petitions to scrap red diesel was posted relatively recently. But it's not got an awful lot of traction. Look yesterday, and I think you need 100,000.
Yes.
I'm going to look it up right now. Petition red diesel. But it was a long way off getting what it needs to be discussed by Parliament. But I just think it's all a bit too late.
Yeah.
Delay removal of red diesel. 13,789 signatures as we talk. So nearly 14,000 signatures. And they need 100,000 to make to get noticed. So that's not, yes,
not very many at all. I'm surprised, actually. I thought they would have quite easily got 100,000.
Hang on, when was it posted? It may have only been 15 minutes. Deadline 4th of August, which means it must have been posted 4th of March because it runs for 6 months. So it's been up for getting on for a couple of weeks and still less than 14,000 signatures, which, I mean, we know how powerful social media is and how these causes can ping around platforms. So it's not like people don't know about it. I think most people are thinking that we've lost that argument, time to move on, which is kind of how I feel.
Yeah, I certainly think that the horse has bolted. I don't think they'll be able to do anything about it now.
However, there's a different, another plea to the Chancellor from the plant hire, the plant users sector, has also been made by the Construction Plant Hire Association, which I have more sympathy with, actually. Because if you remember, at the same time as the Chancellor hit the stick of red diesel, there was a carrot, suggested these things are connected, they're not, but there was a bit of gravy for the construction industry. A couple of years ago, no, last year he announced the the super deduction allowance. You can claim 130% capital allowance on buying plant and machinery until April 2023. And everyone went, fantastic, fill your boots. And lo and behold, actually, plant sales in the UK had a record year.
Oh, did they? Year. Okay, right.
On the back of that. Yep. And not just, it might have been an element of rebound from the pent-up demand of 2020 because of the COVID year. There was not that much buying going on. And 2021 is kind of like double down on their annual renewal of fleets. Super deduction allowance was there as well. Anyway, it wasn't quite as great as everyone had first thought because the plant hire companies weren't entitled to it, and they're the people who buy most of these machines. You're allowed. It's quite complicated. If you supply plant with an operator, and therefore it's not it's clear contractually. It's clearer in the mobile crane side, because you do have the two forms of contract lift and straight crane hire, where the contract lift, the crane hire company, Urainsco's or whoever, are not just supplying a crane, they're providing a lifting service, coming along, planning it, taking the risk of doing it right, etc. Then when they buy their cranes, they can have the capital allowance deduction, whatever it is. It's getting stuck in my tax jargon, but get the tax break. If you are a
Sunbelt, somebody like.
Yeah, or a shop in the high street with lots of, floor sanders and drills and whatever, and people come along and borrow the tool and take it back. No, they don't qualify. And you've also got an awful lot of digger and dumper truck leasing companies, hire companies, who don't send machines out with an operator. It's different between, running a taxi and running a car hire system. And they aren't entitled to it. Which seems slightly to me.
I can see the logic, but
the model of the construction industry is all hire.
Yeah, it is
pretty much.
Yeah, it is.
Anyway, the Construction Plant Hire Association have written to Rishi Sunak saying that it would be quite good to widen the scope of the super deduction allowance, the SDA, so that plant hire companies can benefit as well. And I think that. I think there's more hope there. I mean, it all might be too little, too late, anyway. But I think there's hope there that is something. I think it would be reasonable to push the government, the Treasury, on.
Yeah, I do. I couldn't see the logic, although there is apparently some logic behind the about the refusal to extend it to hire companies and rental services, because they're still buying the equipment. They're still, it's still part of their business. It is their business. It's their core business.
Yeah.
And I think that I certainly think that that is a reasonable request. But Kevin Minton, the CPA chief executive, I think he wants the super deduction made permanent, doesn't he?
Well, that would be nice. Yeah.
Yeah. He said, I think we like this. I'm sure he said, you quoted him in your article, actually, saying the SDA in its existing guise should be extended with a view to making it permanent.
Yeah,
so with a view. Is that until further notice? Or I don't know.
When it emerged that? I mean, it didn't emerge that the plant hire companies weren't allowed to or didn't qualify for the break only a few weeks after the budget. It almost felt like the Treasury were taken by surprise. Someone pointed out, you do know how much money you're giving away here, don't you?
So you think they were quickly, quickly sort of pinch it off. Yeah, yeah.
But again, it seems to me it's only the construction industry that gets the pain on that particular road back.
I'm sure that somebody out there has been crunching the numbers to find out the actual sort of amount of machinery which is supplied onto construction sites through pure hire, and compared with stuff which is provided on a sort of a contract basis and stuff which is actually bought directly by the end user. But I reckon you're probably right that the majority of the equipment you find on the construction site is hired in, and so it probably doesn't have the effect that perhaps a lot of people thought it would.
But there is the wider problem. This is a problem facing every chancellor every time they stand up and make a budget statement, or whether it's spring or autumn statements, is that they want to stimulate the economy. They want to encourage economic activity while giving away as little as possible. And we're in the position this year where the overriding background for the country as a whole is the cost of living crisis.
Mm.
And for business, it's the rising costs of labour, of pay rates and inflation, pay inflation, raw material inflation, which we had last year, which I think seems to be steadying off to a certain extent, not with oil, not with energy. Energy is going through the roof, oil going through the roof, well, coming down a bit now, but has gone through the roof. So that an awful lot of costs, that both for industry and for householders, which the Chancellor, I mean, he will be judged on Thursday, the day in the papers, the day after, is how he has eased the burden or set out to ease the burden of the rising costs on industry and on householders.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, to that extent, yeah, the red diesel thing comes into play there, but it's a toughie. I don't know how he's going to do it.
No, for the halcyon days when Chancellor could say, "I'm not putting up tax on fags and beer," and you get a standing ovation in the house, wouldn't he? Those simple days.
But on the subject of rising costs, we should be appropriate at this juncture to mention Roadbridge, the Irish contractor who's very active in the UK, which has gone into administration this week. I mean, technically, the Irish parent company has gone into receivership. Had different laws of company insolvency in Ireland. But Roadbridge UK Limited in the UK is in administration. And it's not a small business. It turned over nearly 100 million last year, a year before last.
What, in the UK?
I don't have the figures in front of me for Ireland, but I think it's probably, you know, at least that, if not twice as much as that again. Because it's also got, I think it's got a bit of activity in mainland Europe, but it's big job in the UK is the Heads of the Valley project. It's part of a consortium with FCC, Alan Griffiths and Atkins and others on the Heads of the Valley, and that's a big project. It also it's been worked on the Chalfont St Peter vent shaft for a line joint venture on HS2. I don't know if that's current or that's done. I think they're probably still finishing off that vent shaft.
The right.
Tunnel boring machine broke through into that vent shaft just this week, last week. So it's basically done, but I don't know if it still had a role there. But there will be more companies going under for reasons of cash flow, running out of money, with the energy costs, with the fuel costs. If they can't pass on these costs quickly enough to their clients, if anyone's stuck with fixed price contracts, these energy rises and fuel rises are going to hurt a lot of people. The final topic I'd like to talk about today, David, is one I enter with great trepidation, because I don't want to personalise it, but it's hard to avoid it, because I do not know this person, but I think it's an interesting subject.
Okay.
There's a woman called Louise Hardy, who was a top civil engineer at AECOM, and for that Lange O'Rourke, very much involved with leading, Olympic Olympic Park facilities in run up to, was it 2012, the London Olympics?
2012,
yeah. All seems so long ago. It could be 1973, as far as I can remember.
No, 10 years ago.
But
yeah.
She was is an eminent civil engineer, non-executive director of Crest Nicholson, of what used to be Polypipe, now called Genuit, and Severfield, steel construction people. And in December, she became a non-executive, joined the board of Renew Holdings, which is a company whose name is less well known than the bits within it,
right,
which include VP, I think, is the Renew. Am I right? Is that VP? Is it VP?
No, I don't know.
No, no, VP is a different thing altogether. Renew Holdings, I have to quick Google. It's almost like a
Amco Giffen.
That's it. I mean, a decent sized company.
VHE.
Carnell, Lewis, Amco Giffen, Clark Telecom, Seymour, VHE. That's who I was thinking of when I said
that's
VP.
That's it, VHE.
VHE. So, anyway, on the board of London Stock Exchange listed Renew Holdings. Now, that was until December 2021, she joined the new board. And then last week, she got a better offer. And she left the board of Renew and became a main board director of Balfour Beatty, non-executive director of Balfour Beatty, which for many people go, well, absolutely fair play. People change jobs all the time. People change jobs quite quickly. But 3 months on the board of Renew and goes, no, had a better offer over here. Some people may ask, couldn't she do both? If she's got all these other non-execs.
No, yeah, I was going to say, she's got three other non-execs.
I think there's a bit of an overlap between Balfour Beatty and Renew in the way there isn't. I don't think Balfour Beatty overlaps with Crest Nicholson, Polypipe,
no.
I still want to call them. Sorry, I know you call Genuit, and Severfield. Mm. They're all in the construction space, but I think Renew and Balfour Beatty would actually come up against each other from time to time, even though they're very different beasts. There is an overlap, particularly I think in the rail sector, rail contracting.
Yes.
And fair play, if you get offered, you know, if you're playing for Southampton and Real Madrid come in for you, you know, it's an opportunity, you want to go play for Real Madrid. And I get that, but I have a slight sense, it's a bit like, have you ever had the occasion, David, where you've, the neighbours who you're moderately friendly with, but you don't know that well, they've invited you around for dinner or some cousin, and you think, yeah, okay, I'll come, put it in the diary, you know, 12th of May, we'll be there. And then bugging me on the 10th of May, someone says, oh, got a free ticket for the cup final or for the opera or, you know, do you want to come to that?
Oh, I've never been tempted like that, Phil.
I would love to, but actually I've got a prior diary commitment.
Yeah.
Now, to me it's a sense of decency. I mean, maybe I'm strange, but I just think if you've got a prior diary commitment that's in the diary and you get a better offer, unless it's like a funeral or something, you don't jump at the better offer when you've already committed to the to the lesser offer.
Well, yeah, I know.
Am I unreasonable?
Well, I think certainly it looks a little bit unfortunate. But who knows? I mean, maybe she just didn't feel comfortable at Renew. Maybe there were some clash of personalities, something like that.
You're right. I know. And I said at the beginning, I tread carefully here, and I mean no offence to anyone. It's quite possible that the Renew meetings were held on the Isle of Orkney, and she lives in London, and Balfour Beatty meetings were in London, and it just became impossible to get there. It's possible that the other people on the board of Renew treated her badly and expected to make the teas and the coffees and take the minutes. and she thought, well, bugger this. And then, you know, fair play, I'm right with you, get out of there. So I know nothing about any personal circumstances, about any human circumstances. I just thought, if you're going to take a position as a non-executive, I mean, maybe it's different if you're doing it just for the money, if it's a job that you take on as an employee. Although I'd suggest that if you get a job as chief executive at the top level, you've then got a commitment to see it out for a year or two at least.
Sure.
But I just
non-executive directors it's a very different sort of role, isn't it? As a non-exec, it's
you're like a shareholder sort of representative.
Yes, yeah, and you're not sort of you are sort of separated from the rest of the senior management. I have to say, I mean, assuming that it had to be either one or the other, she, you know, there would be a conflict of interest if she served on the board of both contractors. You know, Balfour Beatty is a name to conjure with, isn't it? It's the biggest contractor in the country. It's got a lot of kudos. Renew, as you said, to begin with, you know, it's the name itself conjures bugger all, really. It's the constituent parts which are well known.
Ish,
yeah.
I think she's clearly a in demand person, top of the tree, and it's not like this was a one-off opportunity that wasn't going to come around again. I'm quite sure that if not Balfour Beatty, then someone even grander would have, you know, would have come round in a couple of years' time. That,
yeah,
maybe she agonised over it. And again, you know, Louise Hardy, I apologise for that. Really mean no offence. I just think it's an interesting issue of to what extent should we remain committed to appointments that we commit ourselves to.
Yeah, is it a commitment? In other words, what sort of contract do you sign? A contract of employment with? You are employed by them, but do you sign a contract of employment with somebody when you join their board as non-exec, or do you just have a sort of freelance? Are you a freelancer effectively?
I think there must be a contractual relationship. I've never seen one. I've never signed one yet. I'm still waiting for the day when someone says, Phil, you're just the man we need on our board.
it's an area I know nothing about, I have to admit. You know, you hear, you know, an executive director, non-executive director, they make different sort of pronouncements. They seem to have different roles.
Well, I'm aware that good non-exec directors are absolutely essential, because we see with Carillion as a case in point, where clearly they didn't have good non-executive directors, where they didn't have sufficient oversight, they didn't ask the difficult questions, they just accepted what they were told and, you know, waited for the good lunch that followed the meeting, I suspect, or dinner. So good non-execs who can ask difficult questions without ruffling feathers too much, and, you know, maintaining the equilibrium of the organisation without stirring trouble, but ask the difficult questions, I think are and should be highly prized.
Yeah. I suppose the archetypal image of a non-executive director is a sort of a semi-retired captain of industry, somebody who's been around the block several times and has a wealth of knowledge and wisdom, and basically sits in and says, well, no, I wouldn't do that if I were you, or have you considered such and such?
And, I think a retired partner of Pricewaterhouse would be my vision of a typical non-exec director.
It's an interesting one. I think we've just displayed the depth of our ignorance about the role of non-executive directors here. Or mine,
once again, it's what we do best, David. It's what we're here to do, is to display our ignorance.
Well, we do it very well.
What else do we know nothing about?
I don't know.
Football. That Man United football, lost the game last night. I told you Alex Ferguson was not a good manager. And just the other week, I was making the case that Alex Ferguson should go down as a really bad manager because he did not leave a succession plan behind.
You see, yeah, you did say that. I remember that.
And on that controversial note, it's time to say goodbye, David, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it definitely is. Yeah, I'm running out of steam.
Right, well, thank you once again, everyone, for listening, and to Procore, our sponsors. And we will be back again next week. A simulcast. No, it won't be a simulcast. We don't record live. But David and I, as I mentioned, will be talking before the Chancellor stands up in Parliament to deliver his spiel. So we won't be talking about that next week. We'll be talking about something completely different. Who knows what? But we will see you then. So from David and I, thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.